It's open. Good morning, everyone. We will begin immediately with our adoption of committee rules. Dr. Warner, you want to go over these changes?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, the members of the committee. We have your committee rules. These are the standard joint committee rules that's in OLIS. Just a couple things to point out, because joint committees do have do operate a little bit differently. One of the things you just came across initially here to start the meeting in the work session is you have to have a majority of the appointed members of each chamber to have a quorum. So that's number one. It can't be just a majority of the overall the both committees. These a lot of similar rules apply. Amendments must be made publicly available online for at least an hour before they can be acted on. And again, the affirmative vote of a majority of the appointed members of each chamber is required to pass a measure, table a measure, remove a measure, so forth, and amend a measure. So it's that's always something to keep in mind. Joint committee reports, bills, and resolutions are sent to the floor of either chamber without minority reports. And the when a bill passes through, it'll go to the originating chamber first, and then it just comes to LRO. We process it and send it to the other chamber, so it doesn't come back to the joint committee.
Thank you. Any questions on the committee rules? Seeing none, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move the adoption of the rules as printed.
Representative Barnhart moves the adoption of the committee rules. Any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, committee rules are adopted. Before Dr. Warner's presentation today, I would like to the committee describe the mechanics of kind of how we got to this moment and how I understand at least we will get out. And if I do that, I should go back 2 years ago. The Senate Revenue Committee began looking at ways to flatten out the Swiss Alps. You've all seen that poster in my office. And we began looking at what Ohio did when it replaced its corporate income tax with a commercial activity tax. They were able to offset some other taxes and raise some money for state services. And so the Senate started looking at doing that here and running numbers and cost scenarios and computer modeling and held some very dull and dry hearings. Nobody was in here. And while we were going through that, I think it was received generally pretty well by members of the Senate committee, at least well enough so that that was something that we all thought Oregon should at least consider. And about that time, Public Employees Union started circulating a measure that would eventually become ballot measure 97. And we all thought, well, there may be some common ground there, and maybe there's a compromise in the offing. And so we put together a compromise, which was a much more mellow version of 97, and thought perhaps that we could avoid the nasty campaign that we had. And it was just not to be. There was a lot of testosterone in the air a year ago. And so for the next year, of course, Oregon was subjected to a divisive and expensive ballot measure campaign. And after $40 million and all of that arguing, the measure failed, and Oregon is no closer to where it was, back to square one. So shortly after this session, a work group began looking at whether we could reform the corporate business tax, and if so, how. The Senate was represented by Senators DeBoer, Boquist, and myself. The House was represented by Representatives Barnhart, Nose, and Johnson. We looked at the current corporate income tax and looked at numbers of adjusting the current corporate income tax. But most of the time we spent looking at replacing the current income tax with the Ohio-style activity tax and ran lots of numbers and talked about all of the policies interwoven into that larger policy. And while the budget issues and spending issues did not play into our policy discussions in the work group, we all understood that this revenue package, if there is to be one, is part of the package that also includes the cost containment proposals or some of the proposals that were outlined 12 days ago. We agreed that there will be both of those passing or neither, but it won't be one or the other. So a draft version of what the work group worked on is in LC right now, but the key components such as the rate, the base, and the exemptions will be left blank for this full committee to decide. Essentially, we put together the foundation, the common sense kind of approaches that states with these kinds of taxes put together. We did the easy part. We left the hard parts for you. And it will be hard. There is nothing easy about taxes. You'll be feeling the heat over the next 2 months. But this is what you all signed up for. This is not going to be a resolution to honor a basketball team or the state pie or the state cake. This will be hard. There's an old saying, you can marshal an army to protect the status quo, and that's probably our biggest enemy. Status quo, I always believe, is the enemy of fairness and progress. So that's where we are. I want to assure all of you that this is not pre-wired. There have been no backroom deals. The work group proposal is just that. It is just a proposal. And if anyone has a better plan to look at on how to reform and modernize corporate taxes, let's bring it forward. If we don't do this, it will likely be resolved by another initiative measure. And if you look at Oregon's modern history, Oregon hasn't done well with these initiative measures, especially on taxes. Measures 47, 50, ballot measure 97. So it's on us here in Hearing Room A, and we have a lot of talent up here. We have economists and doctors, lawyers, business people, Rhodes Scholar. I'm actually in awe of the people in this room. So I would just want to thank you in advance for your participation. I always urge my teenage daughter, bring your skepticism, not your cynicism. Bring your good faith, not your bad attitude. And I very much appreciate you all for working so hard and working with good faith. So with that, Dr. Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to move to the witness here to run through some material with you. Mr. Co-Chairs and members of the committee, Paul Warner, Legislative Revenue Office. We've put together some material for you as to what we're titling a framework, kind of based on a lot of the discussions that Senator Hass said, discussion the Senate has had over the last year and a half, and the House has had a series of informational discussions about tax-based issues. And then, of course, we've had the Revenue Work Group that's met eight times over the last couple of months. So this is kind of a culmination of that. So there's a number of pieces here. The first one I've just entitled a Revenue Reform. It's just kind of a history of kind of how we've gotten to where we are in terms of looking at revenue options. It's a little bit autobiographical for me because I was actually hired during a state economist during the Goldschmidt administration, and I know I'm dating myself. But shortly after that, Measure 5 passed, and that, of course, changed the state's public finance system. And so a lot of the discussion, I think, goes back to that time, at least to the modern discussion. If you look at the impact of Measure 5, property tax collections went from 4.9% of personal income to 3.4%. That 1.5% change translated into today's economy is about $1.8 billion per year. So a very significant change in the state's revenue picture. Of course, you know the result of that was a shift in state to the state and responsibility for funding schools. And it left the state largely with a high personal income tax, medium corporate income taxes relative to other states, no retail sales tax, and average property taxes. So we went from a high property tax state to an average one. The other thing we've looked at in both committees is the business tax system in Oregon, and we've spent a lot of time with the Council of State Taxation Studies, our annual studies on business taxes, that show that Oregon does rely less on direct business taxes than does the typical state. And the primary reason for that, again, it goes back to the retail sales tax, the fact that that 42%, according to the cost estimates, of the retail sales tax are paid by businesses. So those are the two parallel paths that have led to the discussion around what are the reform options. The standard answer historically has been to look at a retail sales tax. 45 other states have one. We know, of course, that voters have rejected that in Oregon. But I think there's another factor behind the retail sales tax that at least from a state finance standpoint, I think is extremely important, is the fact that base is eroding over time. And if you look at the percentage of Washington's retail sales tax base, percentage of its economy or personal income, in 1979 it was 60%. And the latest estimates from the Office of the Forecast Council is 38%. So that's the result of not of changes in policy, but changes in the economy. Predominantly, the shift to more remote sales, internet, and also the shift towards services and consumption that typically are untaxed and mostly untaxed in Washington. So that kind of gives you an idea of kind of how we've gotten to where we are. The other issue that Senator Haas mentioned about the corporate income tax, 44 states have one. We've also looked at some of the problems that have arisen around the corporate income tax, including its complexity, its narrow base based on net income. As you recall, we saw a study that estimated that it took a 9% corporate income tax to generate the same amount as a 0.22% gross receipts tax. So the base is very narrow. There's also been a large shift toward other business entity types and away from C corporations, and we see a lot of that in our own data. So that has put us into a situation looking at two business tax-based options, one the value-added tax and the other a gross receipts base. And essentially the discussion around the value-added tax revolved around concerns that to be functional at the state level, the subnational level in the U.S., it really had to be origin-based. And what that means is it had to be based on the factors of production. And the only operational value-added tax we have now in the U.S. is New Hampshire's BET, or business enterprise tax. And that's based on you sum up your wages, your rent, and your interest on your capital. Those are the factors of production. That becomes the base for the tax. That has some sound theoretical reasoning behind it. But the problem is at the state level, it's very difficult for your export-based industries. And in fact, it's exactly the opposite of the way the state has proceeded with its corporate income tax, which is to base our corporate apportionment on sales and to exclude payroll and property as factors determining apportionment. So that's the sales factor approach in Oregon has moved the state in the direction of what we call destination-based taxes, in which the tax is based on where the sale takes place, where the market is, not origin-based or where the product is produced. And that, if we look at that, if that's the policy goal to continue that approach and use destination-based taxes, then the gross receipts tax meets that description. And it also meets the description of having having a broad base, which allows you to have a low rate to generate the amount of revenue that you need with a low non-distorting tax rate. So with that, I'll take you back to another chart that we looked at in the House, again to look at the comparison of those tax bases, and these are basic strengths and weaknesses of each of them. The corporate income tax has the advantage of being part of the personal income tax, companion to it. And that's the way has been seen historically. And you can use a destination-based apportionment, as we have done in Oregon. The weaknesses around that are the complexity. And this both of these committees have seen the complexity around apportionment. They try to determine what's the appropriate method of apportionment, the kinds of issues we have with corporations over what is nexus, for example. So we have continual debates around that. The corporate income tax also is extremely volatile, and we'll go through some data on that with you here in the joint committee. As I said, it has a narrow base. It's based on net income, which is a narrow base. It's the difference between two large numbers, really, receipts and costs. It has slow growth over time, so it's a revenue source that is very volatile. And normally you think of a volatile revenue source like a personal income tax. It has a high elasticity, meaning it's going to grow over time with the economy. But the corporate income tax has exhibited just the opposite. It's very cyclically sensitive, yet over time it has shrunk, like the retail sales tax, as a percentage of the economy. And that has a whole series of reasons behind that. But that's been the case not only in Oregon, but in the U.S. as a whole and throughout the country. So the other issue around the corporate income tax, it is subject to federal nexus standards through Public Law 86272, which does limit the corporations that are taxable in given states. So that's the summary of the corporate income tax, the value-added tax. The key concern, it has some advantages. The key concern is around its origin base at the state level, meaning it's a source-based, source is origin-based. So the gross receipts tax, the advantage here is it has the broadest base, it's destination-based, it's not subject to federal nexus standards, meaning you're gonna be able to tax more entities that are selling into the state, as has been experienced in Ohio. And we do have some recent examples of Ohio and Nevada. We also have some examples of states that have gone away from the gross receipts tax as well. The two primary issues, and these were focused a lot of discussion with the work group, are around the multiple intermediate transactions creates the risk of pyramiding, meaning that you can build that price increase in at multiple stages and end up with a multiple of the base gross receipts rate. If you look at the gross receipts base, it's bigger than the sum of the economy because it's based on transactions, not based on value added. And also, it does lead to some partial shifting to consumers. Now, it's always debatable what proportion that is, but we would suspect that any broad gross receipts tax would have some impact on consumer prices, and that's what our models tell us. So that's kind of where that comparison led to, and we went through this discussion with the work group, and then here's the framework that the work group developed and discussed, and I'll go through that with you and kind of where this would be the guidepost to the drafting of whatever proposal you come with at this point. And of course, that's definitely subject to your modifications. The work group had four real guiding principles, and the one that, and this of course is something that public finance economists harp on ad nauseum, is the advantage of a broad base and a low rate. This leads to the non-distorting taxes that you're going to minimize the decisions and actions of actors in the economy based on the tax rate, which is exactly what you don't want to have. It's a destination-based tax. Simplifies business taxes through the elimination of the corporate income tax and then replaces it with a one-page corporate activities tax, and we'll look at that form again for Ohio's CAT, which we would anticipate something similar if Oregon were to go in that direction. And then the other issue that always comes in is to maintain balanced treatment between the business entity types. Right now we're looking at C corporations paying through a whole different structure than our pass-throughs are, and so to keep those two, maintain balance between the two. So in terms of kind of the key elements of the of where the work group ended up, one is to develop a proposal around gross receipts and emphasize a destination-based tax as they do in Ohio. So it will be based on the privilege of making sales in the state. So that would determine a nexus for tax standards. All business entities would be subject to the tax, so there's no differential. It's based on receipts, not on business entity type. Business entities with annual gross receipts less than $150,000 would not be required to file. And you'll see in a minute when we look at some of the numbers, we think there's probably about 100,000 businesses that would have a less than 150,000. This is based primarily on B&O data from Washington, but that would not be required to file under this filing threshold. And then, as is the case in Ohio, you have a rate threshold, and the work groups settle on the 1 million level, which is what is used in Ohio, and then a $250 flat amount. So what that means is that the tax under the system would be equal to $250 plus the rate, and this is left blank, as Senator Hass said, with pending discussions, particularly with Ways and Means and some of the other taxes like the provider tax options. But $250 plus a percent of gross receipts above a million. So if you had 2 million, it would be 250 plus whatever the tax is on that second million. So, and I'll show you some numbers what that looks like in terms of how many firms we think would be affected in those categories. Ohio has a separate, what they call a FIT, which is a financial institutions tax. We would anticipate something similar to that because of the unique nature of financial institutions, and we see this in terms of the corporate income tax now. We would make some rules that would define gross receipts and have them taxed as close as we can to regular tangible property. And then the other issue was gross receipts from the sale of motor fuel. The work group basically made the decision that should be calculated separately and could be part of some other package, but would not be general fund revenue. Some discussions around exemptions, and this would be a key element as you take the next step into a more formal, detailed development of a bill, would be what are the things that should be exempt. What was included here is government transactions. So, for example, the B&O doesn't, in Washington, they don't have broad exemptions for nonprofits. Instead, they exempt a lot of individual components. For example, donations are exempt and not counted as a receipt. If you're a hospital, a nonprofit hospital, they exempt payments from Medicare and Medicaid. So they're governmental transactions. So that's one way to go about it. In Ohio, what they do is they just exempt all nonprofits. So another exemption would be transactions among closely related business entities. And this is primarily to avoid pyramiding, which would happen if you have different entities, those transactions being taxed and building upon one another. And finally, Ohio has an exemption for qualified distribution centers. You've kind of wrestled with a similar issue with Measure 67 around the co-ops. If the ultimate destination of the product is outside the state, it's really an export. What Ohio does is you have to meet certain qualifications, and you'd be exempt if that's going to be ultimately for a sale in Illinois, for example. So credits, we looked at the tax credits, and one of the things that the work group discovered, and I hadn't realized as much until Chris explained it to us, that the business energy tax credit that we've heard that both these committees have spent so much time on are largely worked themselves through the system. We're only around 25 million of those left. And then the other one floating around out there is the R&D credit, where we have a lot of unused credits. The work group's recommendation was to go ahead use those, allow the firms to use those credits. They also talked about a pass-through entity credit, and the idea would be for if you're, for example, an S corporation and you have a certain liability, you grow over a million in sales, you'd have a liability, and you would take that liability, and there would be a percentage set in statute that you would allow to use as a credit. So let's say 50%. Then if you had a 50% credit against your CAT liability or corporate activities liability, then that would be taken and distributed among all the partners in that entity, the partners or the shareholders. So it would be spread and dispersed that way to protect pass-throughs from getting a full hit from the tax. The tax-based description, when we look at the numbers, and I'll show you some more detail here in a minute, but just to give you an overview of the numbers, I mentioned about 100,000 we think are below the 150 threshold, again, using the Washington B&O data. We think that those that would pay the flat 250 would be about 37,000. So there's a lot of businesses in that group. We see that both in Ohio and in Washington, that there's a lot of businesses that are under $1 million in receipts, and we're estimating about 37,000. Those that would pay the rate with $1 million threshold are about half that, about 18,000. So, and then if you look at kind of this percent distribution by gross receipts, those above 25 million would be about 74% of the liability. Those above 100 million would be about 56% of the liability. So those are the kind of the breakout. As I say, we'll look at some more detail on what those are in just a minute. The final thing here is the personal income tax adjustments. One of the things we do know from our models tell us that you will see some impact on consumer prices, and we know that that does have a disproportionate impact on lower income households. So some discussion, certainly no final decision, but some discussion around some of the options that could be included that could offset that impact at the lower and lower middle end. And of course, one obvious ones, targeted one, would be the earned income tax credit. But lower bottom personal income tax rates, an increase of standard deduction, or another one would be an increase in Oregon's personal exemption credit, which is now about $193. So that would, those are the kind of options that would be more, you could have a combination of those, but of course, any options that you use here end up affecting your revenue target. So that there's that interplay between those kinds of credits and what you ultimately have to use in terms of the rate. And the strategy always is to try to keep that rate low to minimize distortions. So that's kind of the framework. So I think both committees have seen this, but just a reminder to you what a corporate activity tax would look like. It would be, this is the one-page form that comes out of Ohio. There's a page of instructions, and you'd have to have there's a registration requirement, so you'd register your entity type and what your anticipated sales are. And then this would be the one-page a form. You can see that there in Ohio they have the issue also around the highway fund, where they have a separate line there for gross receipts from motor fuels, and then of course the Ohio Department of Taxation separates that out and sends it to the highway fund, and then the rest of your gross receipts would go into the general fund. And you can see there's a calculation for the minimum, and then the net tax would be the minimum plus Ohio's rate, which is 0.26% of receipts above $1 million. So again, it would be a one-page calculation for taxpayers. And then what Ohio does is have quarterly returns that are filed. Next table I have here is on the revenue impact estimates, and there are you can see that those come out a little bit clearer on OLAS. Basically, what we did was we looked at four different rates, just to give you a sense of what that range is, and we also incorporated an elimination of the corporate income tax. So if you look on the chart, we've got four rates, 0.25, 0.5, 0.75, and 1%. We also looked at kind of to think in terms of targets, how a 0.01% change in the rate, how that would affect your revenue for the biennium. So that can give you an idea that, gee, if we went from 0.5 to 0.51, well, how much revenue would there be, or to go the other direction. So you can see that it's pretty much linear adjustment, but you do have an impact from the minimum, and that influences that because of not being quite exactly. And these, of course, are all static estimates with no economic feedback, in which we'll, as you get closer and discuss some alternatives in more detail, we'll provide you with some estimates based on our general equilibrium model. You can see the estimates. The assumption here is that the you would be able to establish a corporate activities tax based on, in this case, based on the Ohio tax base, where I've also included a financial institutions tax that would generate a comparable amount. And it would be effective 1/1/18. So as you get closer to discussions about the specifics, that, of course, becomes an issue for the Department of Revenue. Obviously, they have to gear up and get ready for a whole new tax system. So that would be a key element in your planning as you get to the next stage in more detail. I was just looking at the Measure 1, which was passed in 1993 by the legislature in August, was on the ballot in November. That was the last retail sales tax approved during the Roberts administration. And what that Measure 1 had a start date of May 1. So that kind of gives you how they were looking at it. Of course, they had a ballot measure that had to in November as well. So, but anyway, that's something that you'd have to think about. The other issue is around the corporate income tax, which we think over time would greatly simplify the system to make this change. But there would also be a transition period where you'd have to be managing both taxes, particularly the liability from past years on the corporate income tax. So those are kind of practical issues. And then you look on the bottom block there, you can see what we would anticipate in terms of revenue, assuming 18 months of revenue for 17-19 with the new corporate activities tax. You'd be around $290 million for 0.25% and around $2.2 billion for a 0.75%. If you go for a full biennium in 1921, you would see about $1.9 billion for a 0.5 and about $3.3 billion for a 0.75. So that's just to give you some sense of what the magnitude of those numbers are. There is, I think, an important aspect over time to keep in mind about these two taxes. Again, the corporate income tax is volatile. You look at the projections here, they're very flat. Well, the reason for that is we don't have a recession built into the forecast. So those are just trend, and the trend is flat. But if you look over time, it's way up and way down with a flat trend, moving up and down over the course of the business cycle. We would anticipate that the revenue from the corporate activity tax would grow not as fast as the personal income tax. It'd have a lower elasticity, but it would be pretty close to growth of the overall economy. So it would tend to grow. If the economy grows 4-5% in nominal terms, it would be around that growth rate. So, and we'll look at that in a little bit more detail with you, because that's to think about what the implications are for state finance. So the final pieces I have are to look at the Ohio data in detail. And what we've done is we would assume a similar distribution to Ohio. We've estimated a little bit more on the less than million based on what we see from the B&O tax, but the rest of these categories are pretty close to what we would expect to see in Oregon. So we've scaled this basically to the size of Oregon's gross domestic product relative to Ohio's. By the way, we're about a third of the size of Ohio. So you can see again that if you're looking at the total number of filers, we're looking at about 51,000 here from the Ohio data, about 60% of which are less than a million. So you can see as that category goes up. And then, for example, if you were to say set the threshold at 5 million, you can see the number of additional firms that you would add in there that would be significant. Actually, you would cut it to almost by two-thirds. The 18,000 would be cut down to about 6,000 if you had a 5 million threshold. So that's something you may want to think about in terms of how that would work itself through. We would recommend, though, that you do keep a separation between the rate, the rate threshold and the filing threshold. So you'll still get businesses filing and paying a minimum, so they're in the system and used to being in the system. So that would, for compliance purposes. Now, on the other hand, you can see, and I've just plugged in three different rates there based on the Ohio data for FY16 of 0.26, 0.52, and 0.78. But I think the most interesting column is the last one, because that shows you what we would anticipate the percentage change to be, or the percentage liability for firms of that size, sales of that amount. So for over a billion, you'd have about 23%, or almost a quarter. And over 100 million, you would have about 56%. So that gives you a sense of how that breaks down. Now, the other thing we can do from Ohio is to look at industries, and this is definitely an eye test. You can see the industries where they are and how that would break out. And the percentages out here at the end. So if you look at the major tax sectors would be, as you'd expect from the economy, about 27% from manufacturing. Now, keep in mind, this is manufacturing industry, so it would include not only those that manufacture in Oregon, but those that manufacture outside the state and sell into the state. So it's not a measure of the amount of manufacturers that our exporters pay. One of the things we did find when we made the switch to the single sales factor, we looked at corporations over $1 billion in sales, and when you shifted from the property payroll apportionment formula to our sales only, more firms got an increase in taxes than got a decrease. But the ones that got a decrease got a much larger decrease because of the sales factor. They were the ones that had the large property and payroll in the state. So you would still see that same kind of distribution because it's destination-based to the tax. Retail trade's about 20%, wholesale trade about 12%. So that would be a similar kind of breakdown we see from the C corporations when we had looked at Oregon sales through Measure 97. But keep in mind, though, this basis is not the Oregon sales definition that was used in the apportionment formula for the corporate income tax. This is all market-based, so you don't have the cost of performance apportionment factor that affects services. That goes away here. This is all based on where the market is. So in effect, you'd go to a market-based allocation for services as well as tangible goods. So, Mr. Chair, that's all we have for now. And
Paul, did you want to mention the income tax cut or the personal reduction in the discussion around that?
Yes. So if you look at our framework, the last page, we talked a little bit about some of the target low-income households. There are really four ways you can do that. The beauty of the income tax has always been that it's flexibility. A lot of things you can do with it, but these would be four examples. Senator Hass has looked at a reduction in the personal income tax rates overall. That would certainly be one option to proceed. The advantage of that is it lowers marginal rates, which are seen as having the most impact on behavior. But then there are some other options that would be there. We can run any of these elements in a package, and you could see how it affects the distribution of the tax burden. So you can target it where you're most concerned about the impact.
All right, there's a lot to digest there. Questions of Dr. Warner? Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair and colleagues. After 18 years in the legislature, this is my first time on revenue, so I hope you'll be patient with me as I try to get up to speed. Paul, as we talk about corporations, I'm trying to get my arms around the definition of corporation. Would this include cooperatives that are filed as corporations? I'm thinking of grain growers. those type of folks.
Mr. Co-Chairs, Representative Smith, yes, it would be all entity types, and so those, many of those are organized as C-Corps. So they would be part of it. Now, the one thing that we've, of course, had to deal with the co-ops on the Measure 67, and I would anticipate something similar here, is to make an adjustment for those when you have the growers themselves selling to the co-op, and that, you know, that wheat is not consumed in Oregon. It's shipped all over the world. So there's an exemption allowing for that transaction on the corporate minimum, and we are anticipating something similar to that if you go this route with a receipts-based tax.
Follow up, Mr. Co-Chair.
Sure.
What about community development corporations, nonprofit community development corporations, any allowance as well for them?
As I mentioned, when we started the discussion around exemptions, we looked at the Ohio model, which is exempts all nonprofits. And so if you look at the data here, our revenue estimates, it's based on that base. The work group also looked at some other data, the 990s, for example, looking at nonprofits and looked at, you know, what are the proportions of some of those nonprofits in terms of their donations, which would clearly be exempt, but there's also a large stream of service income. And this is particularly a significant factor for the hospitals, most of which are nonprofits. So that's, you know, kind of where that debate ends up is a lot of that depends on where the provider tax work group comes up with and where they end up going. So that's a kind of an interaction between those two plans. But right now, our estimates are based on the assumption that the nonprofits are exempt, and although I don't think there's a consensus on their work group that necessarily that's the way you want to go, or they may want to have some exceptions.
Follow up. Thank you. We talked about the Oregon Department of Revenue and that this would be new to them. Has the work group or have you folks had any conversation with them about how their new GenTech system could accommodate this transfer? I'm assuming it's relatively easy, but I just want to know if that's the case.
Representative Smith and Mr. Co-Chair, yeah, we've had some preliminary discussions with them. We've had Senator Haas mentioned a rough draft that we've gone through, and we've actually had councils drafted some commercial activity type taxes in the past. So we've had them go through that and give us some input on areas where they would anticipate issues. But we haven't gotten to that detailed level of discussion at this stage, but certainly that's a key element. As I said, our anticipation would be that this would be a less expensive tax to administer over time. But again, you have a transition period where you're going to have both taxes up and operational at the same time as you're clearing out the corporate income tax. Another thing to keep in mind about the current corporate income tax is the way the filing schedule works. Businesses, you know, they choose their fiscal year. So you'd have the corporate income tax would be eliminated for corporate tax years beginning 1/1/18 or whenever that start date is. And so you'd have kind of a staggered effect on the corporate returns and when they stop coming in.
Got it. Just two more follow-up and then I'll be done. It's really interesting. All of us have already started receiving the phone calls and the emails of vote no on everything or vote yes on everything before the details have even been released.
Yes.
And I appreciate, Mr. Co-Chairs, that you've, I think you've got a good group of folks here that are open-minded. And so I have two questions that are genuinely asked with an open mind. Do we have any evidence or has any evidence been provided to the committee that this new form of taxation has discouraged economic development in Ohio? Or encouraged economic development in Ohio?
Mr. Co-Chairs, Representative Smith, we've talked a lot with Ohio about their experience. And of course, you know, all situations are unique. They packaged their CAT with a reduction, with an elimination of what they call their franchise tax, which was their corporate income tax. And they said they had a lot of complaints about that, about its complexity, and there was a lot of support to eliminate it. But they also coupled it with a reduction in personal property taxes on business. So that was a significant factor, as they described to me. They're a capital-intensive economy, and that was a significant factor. So the net that they felt of those changes was generally positive for the Ohio economy. Of course, the cat went into effect in 06, and, you know, 2 years later, the world is in the Great Recession, so it obviously distorted the data at that stage. But in terms of their relative position, I think there's been a general consensus that it's been a simplification and overall positive for business.
Perfect. My final question. And again, I'm new to the committee, and you know I have a high level of respect for you. I'm looking at your chart of comparison of business tax base options, and under the weaknesses, you talk about with the gross receipts tax that there's a partial shifting to consumer. You make, or your staff makes the same comment under value-added tax. We don't say that under the corporate income tax. I can't imagine that corporations today still aren't passing that on to their consumer. Isn't under our current form of taxation, can't we make that argument as well? And I'm not trying to split hairs. I'm just...
Well, Representative Smith, it's safe to say that a lot of ink has been spilled over this issue over the years. And, you know, it has been debated. From my perspective, and if you look at it theoretically, a sales factor-based, destination-based apportionment formula would tend to generate more of a shift on consumers, because it's based on Oregon sales. So, I mean, so it has that same base. So, whereas on the other hand, if you have more of an apportionment based on the other factors, property and payroll, some of the literature suggests that you do see some backward shifting in that case as well, which you would see shifting onto labor and other factors of production. But of course, a corporation is rarely in a situation where, if they're an exporter, where they can shift a state tax on into a world market where they're a price taker. They're much more likely to be in a position of shifting prices on for domestic goods that are in a domestic market where everybody's paying that tax.
Got it. Thank you. Mr. Kocher, thank you for letting us ask questions.
Sure. Good questions. Further questions down here? Representative Mills.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Dr. Warner, what do you think, other than the rate, which we haven't settled on, what do you think is one of the key differences between the approach that the work group developed as compared to, say, Measure 97?
I think there's a number of differences, Representative Nose, and I know Senator Haas has thought a lot about this, too. I think one of them clearly is a broader base.
Okay.
As you recall from Measure 97, we were looking at about 1,000 C corps that are going to pay additional taxes. Under this proposal, it'll be about 18,000 with a 1 million threshold, about 6,000 with a 5 million. So there would be a broader base. The rates, of course, are considerably lower that we've looked at. We haven't looked at anything above 1% versus the 2.5%. And I do think one of the key distinctions too is that this is looking at a new tax and a new tax base. Measure 97 was built on the corporate minimum structure, so that meant that you had all those definitions that went along with the corporate income tax followed you along. And the one that I know you wrestled with a lot was the cost performance, where in the service-based, it really isn't destination-based. It's based on where the service is performed, and that counts as an Oregon sale, which may not be that big a deal for a small minimum, but if once that was increased, then it may be a lot bigger issue. The other issue, too, as we've mentioned a number of times around the corporate income tax, are the nexus standards that are associated with that, that you have. If your activity in a state is strictly for the purposes of soliciting sales, and Chris has gone through this with both committees, then you don't meet the federal corporate nexus standards, and you can't be taxed. So as a corporate income. But as a privilege for a receipts-based tax, it is a broader definition. This is one of the experiences that Ohio has had, that they were able to draw in firms from out of state that were not paying taxes before because it's a privilege tax. You see this, and we hear it from some Oregon businesses, that, and you may have well have heard this from your constituents, that end up with getting a bill from Olympia for the B&O tax saying that you've got nexus here. And that could, that, so it's a broader definition and could be as another factor that leads to a broader base.
Representative Bueller.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair House. Paul, we hear a lot about the states that have newly enacted the gross receipts tax, but my review of the literature, there's also been several states that have stopped the gross receipts tax in the recent past because of negative adverse consequences. Could you touch upon those states' experience with the gross receipts tax and why they've stopped?
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Bueller, we have seen that in some states, and there's a good article from the Tax Foundation that goes through those, and we can make that available for the committees. The one area where we know we've seen some move toward a gross receipts tax and then backing off has been in the area of a corporate minimum, such as we used in Oregon. New Jersey, in particular, had a pretty significant increase in their corporate minimum, which is based on gross receipts, and it generated significantly more revenue than ours does relative to our corporate income tax. That met with a lot of backlash, and eventually New Jersey eliminated that option, went with a strictly corporate income tax. The other one I know of is Indiana, for a long period of time, which I believe had an assortment of different rates on gross receipts, though the decision was made to move away from that and go to something more uniform. But I can get that that material for the joint committee, so you can look through that.
That'd be great. Thank you.
Representative Marsh.
Thank you for sharing. So, on the question of impact on consumers, and we've already heard a lot of claims about that. But I am assuming that if we take the formulary and we fill in some designated tax rates and some other assumptions, that you can actually model some of these options for us so that we actually get the science behind that claim.
Mr. Co-Chair, as Representative Marsh, yes, we can look at, we have in our general equilibrium model, we have 9 different household groups from less than 20,000 to greater than 205,000. So we can look at how we think that would affect the distribution of the tax burden, what we call final incidence, which builds in the effects of employment losses or wage changes and consumer prices. So we can look at that, and we've done this quite a bit in the past. We did it a number of times with the tax reform options report we did a couple of years ago, where you can look at different, as we suggest, look at different personal income tax options that could offset that, and you can see how it would affect, or how at least the model shows it would affect the distribution of the tax burden. So that'll give you an opportunity to have to see how different packages would work.
Great.
Further questions, Representative Benz?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for all the work you've done on this extremely difficult issue. I did read the article from the Tax Foundation. They're pretty negative about gross receipts tax. Their words are, sadly, a number of states are proposed to repeat the folly of their peers with the resurgence of a gross receipts tax is largely resigned to the trash heap of history. Gross receipt taxes are currently being considered as part of the tax plan in 4 states, we being one of them. And they go walk through the negative outcomes in the states that have recently repealed them. You are more familiar with the frailties of the device than most. I'm just going to ask one question of many, and it has to do with the C corporations being basically backed out under this proposed plan, and then being only subject to whatever they would pay under a gross receipts tax. And I find that odd, after all we've heard about how they're not paying their fair share. What seems odd, and perhaps it doesn't matter which device we ultimately select, is that there'll be inequities in how we do it. But I just want you to just address one. And I use Roth's grocery store down here as the example. They do a huge volume, very low margin. And as compared to, let's say, Intel or another large corporation that might have a much higher profit margin, where's the what are we trying to do when we say we're going to tax gross receipts? Where's that nexus between whatever it is we're trying to tax on the one hand versus how much we're taking on the other? Explain, if you will, that underlying justification for this approach as opposed to the income tax approach, which has other frailties but still justifications. You know them better than most of all of us.
Mr. Vice Chair, I think there's a number of issues in that question. I think first of all, if you address the fairness issue, equity. If you look at equity, and we normally think of it, particularly with a personal income tax, around ability to pay, which makes sense. I mean, that's kind of the basis for it. But oftentimes when you look at other taxes, in particular business taxes, you look at a different approach, which would be a benefit approach. So if you're thinking about businesses or property owners that receive services from the public sector, then their benefit could be measured by some a variable that measures their size relative to the economy. And that's where a gross receipts tax comes in. It's more of a benefit approach. You recall, I'm sure, very vividly this in 2009, we came around the debate about was $10 a sufficient corporate minimum. Everybody said, no, that's ridiculous to pay $10. But yet, if you're going strictly on a net income basis, $10 is too much. If you don't have any net income, it should be zero. So that led to a discussion, okay, that's not right. We should look at another measure of presence in the economy. And at that time, the decision was made, we talked a lot about value added, but the decision was made that Oregon sales or gross receipts was a measure of a presence or size in the economy. So you are shifting to a benefit approach and away from a more ability to pay approach. Now, you could argue there's advantages and disadvantages to that, but that would be the approach. The other thing from a state finance standpoint, of course, it makes a significant difference because you're going to a much more stable base where you have, the present size of the business is contributing a certain amount to the public sector based on their relative size, not variations in their net income. So, again, it's much more reflective of their presence in the economy. It stabilizes the state's financial stream significantly, and over time, it grows more over time. It doesn't shrink as our current base does. So those are the kind of factors that would come into play for your decision. The other thing, too, I think we should always keep in mind how our state taxes interact with federal taxes. Because at the federal level, you do have a net corporate income tax. You also have a net personal income tax. So it's you should look at those in combination.
Representative Benz, embedded in your question, though, is something that we wrestled with in the work group on what's a fair rate for a grocer versus a software company. I don't know that we said it's definitely one way or the other, but the appeal of Ohio is its simplicity, the one rate. But Washington State and Nevada set lower rates for low margin wholesalers, retailers, and I think Washington goes up to 1.5% for service. So while it may complicate what's easy for us, there is some virtue in debating different rates for different sectors.
Mm-hmm. Follow up to?
Sure.
Thank you both for the answers to the question or questions. I want to go back again to that justification because I don't want to look at the states, the ease that we may enjoy in applying the tax. I want to go back to the other side, which is the justification for basing any tax upon just how much volume one runs through the door and the inequities that this is really transferring over to the pyramiding issue. And I like to use Amazon as the example because as a vertically integrated company with huge volume, they may well be very happy about a low gross receipts tax as opposed to an alternative means of paying for what they do here in this state. But for those that aren't so fortunate as to control all of those layers of sales above them, and how do we approach this inequity created by a tax on each level of production?
Mr. Chairs and Mr. Vice Chair, the pyramiding is something that's endemic to the gross receipts tax. So you're going to have that as an issue. There's ways to mitigate it. The way that Ohio has done it is through keeping that overall rate low. And as Senator Haas mentioned, other states have looked at the tiering structure. Another possibility the work group talked some about is you can, what I describe tiering horizontally across different industries, which adds complexity. You could also tier vertically by sales. So you would have, you know, a certain rate. You would have a flat amount up to the rate threshold. Then you could have a 0.3 or something up to a certain amount, and then a marginal rate of 0.4, 0.5 or something above that. So you could tier it based on sales, so there would be some protection for those intermediate suppliers that may be less vertically integrated. So there's some steps you could take. And, of course, the other thing, the other approach a lot of states use, certainly Washington has used this extensively, is exemptions. You can exempt sectors from the tax, basically.
Thank you.
Further questions? Senator Bertschinger.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. We all know the sales tax conversation doesn't go so well in Oregon. And one of the arguments was it's a tax on the low wage earners in Oregon. How is this any different? When I look at corporations that have very small margins, they're simply going to have to increase what the price of that is. And so that it doesn't matter if you're in the top 10% or the bottom 10% wage earners, you're going to be paying the same for goods and services. How is it any different?
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Bertschinger, there's a couple of things that we have run, and we can show you the results, just a straight retail sales tax against a straight gross receipts tax. And you're right that you are going to see consumer prices affected by both. But our models at least show a more proportional distribution through the gross receipts tax than through a traditional retail sales tax. We think that's because you see that more distributed across entity types that are in high income ranges. But it's still regressive in its marginal effects, but it is less so than a retail sales tax. The other thing to keep in mind, of course, in most states that have a gross receipts tax also have a retail sales tax, so they're stacking them on one another. So we would anticipate that, you know, that being if you keep your rates low and you don't have an existing retail sales tax, then you'll see some rise in consumer prices, but you may be able to keep that down and not be as large as it would be in some other states. And then, of course, the last step is what we have traditionally recommended from a kind of a tax administration standpoint is I think you're better off, rather than try to exempt certain things to offset the impact on lower income households, it would be to use your income tax. And you could use your credits on your income tax, your personal exemption credit, for example, those kind of things you could use and target where you think their effect would be biggest. And yeah, I mean, you can also, one of the things we've talked about in the Senate committee some is around the property tax and its regressive impact for residential property taxes. Another possibility would be looking at some kind of circuit breaker where you could provide some property tax relief at the low end to offset some of those consumer prices. So there's a lot of options you would have to deal with that.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you. Further questions?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Thank you, Dr. Warner, and thank you for the work group for their work. So if I understood right, with the framework that we currently have, there's ways to mitigate and come up with strategies to offset the impacts for low-income communities. And can you briefly just mention, it was low-income tax credit, what were the other options?
So, Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Hernandez, these bottom four were just kind of ones that we had looked at, and the work group actually looked at some examples and what the revenue impact would be of those kinds of things. Those four at the bottom, I think the most targeted would be the earned income tax credit. That is, you know, you're targeting that. Of course, the one limitation on that is you have to be working. So it is a You have to be a working person. If you're not, then you're not going to benefit from that. That's where, you know, as I mentioned, we'd also thought about some ideas such as a circuit breaker, particularly for seniors, because they end up with a high effective rate on the property tax because they have low current income, yet they're paying, you know, their home ownership. So that would be at one. If you increase the personal exemption credit, for example, that would be very targeted, low to middle income. The personal exemption credit, as it stands now, is goes away at $100,000 and $200,000. So you're not none of that is spilling into the higher income groups. It's all targeted to lower and middle. So we can look at some detailed options for you if you want to go down that path and give you a sense of how that would be distributed and what the revenue impacts would be.
A different question. Thank you, Co-Chair. For those states that have moved away from gross receipts tax, do you know, they also have sales tax, I imagine. Is our framework that we have comparable to the frameworks in which they had, and how sales taxes in their states played a factor in that?
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Hernandez. Yeah, I think that's a very good point. I mean, that we start from a unique position. We're only one of five states that doesn't have a retail sales tax. Those other states that had gross receipts tax do. You could argue that, in effect, in the Washington system, I mean, they've doubled down on consumption taxes by having a fairly large B&O tax plus a very high retail sales tax, of course, no income tax. So I think and we've looked at some of those implications in terms of business taxes and also in terms of the distribution of taxes. So we do start from an unusual situation. It is one of the things, I think, that, you know, if you think about diversifying Oregon's system, naturally you're led to looking at these consumption tax options, which are the ones we've talked to: retail sales tax, gross receipts tax, or value-added tax. So that's the area where you see us imbalanced if you compare us with other states. And even the states that don't have a general retail sales tax have some pretty unique features, like Montana, for example, or Alaska. They both have very large natural resource sectors where they draw a lot of revenue from their severance taxes.
Paul, what's the percentage of sales tax that businesses generally pay in a sales tax state?
Mr. Co-Chair, that's, you know, I've looked at percentages in around 25% to 30%, but in the cost study, it's 42%. So that's a higher number than what I've typically seen, but that's what they assume, and that's in that Ernst & Young study. They've consistently used that proportion.
Senator Fernandez, did you have another question?
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair. So I looked at the Ohio form, and it's pretty much a page. And when I was learning about our corporate income tax and centralized assessment, it seemed very, very complicated. And one of the things that turned me off was not every corporation or business paid income taxes. How hard is it, or how would the application or pages, if you will, does the corporate income tax compare to that one page? Simplistic page that we just saw for the gross receipts tax.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Hernandez, yeah, there's depending, particularly for larger corporations, there's a very high volume of material that comes with it. But we'll get an example. We'll pull something from Department of Revenue and bring that in, so you can see exactly what it would look like comparatively speaking.
It would be great to see a visual. Maybe I'm imagining a bunch of binders, and then one pager for this system.
Yeah. And of course, it depends on the complexity of the corporation. I mean, some of them pay the minimum, maybe not. But those that are, you know, operating in 50 states, then you're going to see a much more complicated return.
Just one last question. Thank you, Co-Chair Hess. For businesses that currently are taxed through the income tax system that export, this new system would encourage, I believe, and I'm assuming, export companies here in Oregon to do much more of that type of business. Would this gross receipts tax encourage that?
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Hernandez, the gross receipts tax we're looking at, the Ohio version, would be destination-based. So let's say you're a pass-through entity, an S corporation, and you export most of your product. Now you're only paying the corporate minimum, 150. So there would be an impact. You wouldn't get any. You wouldn't have direct relief for your income tax rates. Those would stay the same still because that's not changed. The one area you wouldn't be subject to, if you're big enough, subject to the corporate activities tax. And that's why we're looking at having a some type of a credit against what your corporate activities tax would be. But if you are an S corp that's focused now primarily on exports, that means your receipts in Oregon are going to be relatively low. So they, you know, if all your product is sold in Oregon, then you would tend to have more of an impact. So you wouldn't be damaged by that switch. But you also right now you're only paying the minimum, so you wouldn't get much relief either. And that's why we've suggested the idea of this credit against whatever your CAT liability is.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let me finish up Representative Hernandez's question. Assume his question, and we're talking about a services company that pays the current taxes in Oregon as a service corporation, and make that comparison that he asked you for.
Mr. Co-Chair, there would be a significant change if you are an exporter of intangible property, a software or service company, and most of your cost of performance is here. Under current law, then your Oregon sales are defined as all your activities in the state. Switching to this destination-based would mean that you would have relief from you basically wouldn't be subject to anything sold outside the state. So that service company would benefit from that shift. The service companies that would not benefit from this shift would be those that are outside the state now, that their services performed outside the state and they sell into Oregon. Now, basically, in many cases, they don't have any liability because their majority of their services are performed outside the state. This change would mean they would be subject to the corporate activities tax based on their sales in Oregon.
Thank you. And then a different topic, if I may. A minute ago, you were talking about the ultimate distribution of the tax. When you've described this kind of tax in other contexts, you've discussed other ultimate payers. Could you describe that a bit?
In terms of who bears the ultimate burden?
Right, thank you.
Okay. We would, now, when, you know, we do make this distinction between business and households, and that's one distinction that can be useful and can give you some sense and some policy decisions. But ultimately, economists believe, and the economic theory indicates, that taxes are going to be borne by people in some activity, either as owners of capital, shareholders, consumers through consumer prices, or workers through their wages, or through some type of ownership of a natural resource. So the owners of capital and natural resources can be affected, workers can be affected to their wages, or consumers through prices. So that's where you try to divide up what those effects are. Ultimately, in economics, it largely depends on the flexibility of that owner of that resource. What other options do they have? Do they have options over, do they have price, some influence over price? You know, the economists have long considered the most efficient tax, and you've heard this from the folks that have talked about land value taxation, is the tax on land, the site value of land, because it's perfectly immobile. You can't take it anywhere. So you're unlikely to shift any of that tax. On the other hand, a tax on capital may well be shifted because you may decide regionally where you're going to invest, and the tax rate may influence that. So you get those kinds of shift that are influenced by the options or the flexibility or what economists call the elasticity of those owners of those factors of production.
Follow-ups. Thank you. Apparently, I asked the wrong question because I was aiming at a different thing. One of the things I'm aware of, and I think everyone on the committee is that Oregon is a donor state when it comes to federal taxes. We send more money out of Oregon as federal tax payments than we get back in federal services. And my recollection is that when you've discussed this kind of topic before, you've talked about how the nature of this tax leads to a slightly different outcome. Could you describe that? I'll be more explicit.
Okay.
I believe what you said in the past is that because of the way this tax is administered, the federal government will bear part of the burden
of the tax
yes. because of the deductibility of this tax by the business.
Yes. Yes, Mr. Chair, and in fact, we're looking at how to factor that in. You can deduct it on your federal corporate income tax, any state and local taxes. So if we increase tax on businesses, you get additional deductibility on your federal return, and that, in effect, exports a portion of the tax to the federal government. The other thing that you would do, if you're a pass-through entity, you would have, in effect, you'd be able to deduct against your pass-through income, which, again, you would be able to use on your federal return as well as your state return. So there is some offsetting effect on federal taxes through deductibility.
Thank you. Thank you. And that shows how good I am at a leading question at two tries. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Dr. Warner. Follow up to Representative Hernandez and Representative Barnhart's question before making a statement. But did I hear you correctly in terms of technology corporations that, in short and in simple, that if we went to a CAT or a gross receipts tax, that Portland technology companies would pay less taxes? Is that correct?
Mr. Vice Chair, no. The tax would depend on how you're apportioned now. So if you are currently a Portland-based company and you provide an intangible and you sell it to other states, all of your income is apportioned to Oregon if that's where you perform it, the service. But if you're a technology company based in Seattle and you're selling software services into Oregon, into Portland and the rest of Oregon, you're not going to be subject to the corporate income tax because it's apportioned based on where you perform that service. But if you were to make a shift into the corporate activities tax, then that Seattle-based company would have sales in Oregon that would be subject to the corporate activities tax.
Just I want to go back to your bottom bullet up here on the screen, and that's the personal income tax adjustments targeted for low incomes. The top two, as you know, I'm not a keen fan of. Just briefly, I mean, the expanded earned income tax credit, of course, is a one-time credit you get a year and a half later if the Department of Revenue and the IRS haven't sent you, you know, three rejection letters in a row intentionally, and intentionally by rule kicked that application down the road. But that's a one-time credit about 18 months later. And I want you to confirm that. Then the lower bottom, if you lower the personal income tax rate at the bottom, that of course applies to everybody, the first portion of that. And so really the most targeted for low-income families is either increase in standard deduction with the threshold at the top or increase in personal exemption with the threshold at the top. Am I correct?
That's right, Mr. Vice Chair. The personal exemption credit, both the personal exemption credit and the standard deduction would reduce taxes at the low end, but also the lower middle end as well. The standard deduction, because you can have itemizers, everybody's an itemizer above, you know, $50,000 to $75,000. At the lower, and the personal exemption credit does have a cap at $100,000 and $200,000. So those two would spread the benefit up into the lower middle to middle income groups. earned income tax credit is really focused at the low end, and of course it has a big effect at the low end because of its refundability.
Just a point of clarification, and for the standard low income taxpayer and the payment schedule, or out of your salary, the increase in the standard deduction and the increase in the personal exemption, of course, are calculated into those tables. So therefore, the low-income family would receive those basically as you go along through the 12 months because they're part of the calculation of the table initially versus the earned income tax they have to file for 18 months later, correct?
That's correct, Mr. Co-Chair. And yeah, I mean, people don't always follow the guidelines of the table, but those are built in. So those two would likely translate into lower withholding and get cash flow benefits right away.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Marsh.
Thank you. Thank you, Co-Chair. Dr. Warner, I want to ask sort of a bigger picture question. We know we come into this session with a revenue problem. We know we have fundamental problems in our basic tax structure. Can you say anything about the implications of a failure to act on future biennia?
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Marsh. I think there's a number of things. If you look at kind of the longer term, of course, I think the most significant fiscal message about the situation the state is in now, where we're projecting about a $1.6 billion shortfall, is the fact that we're projecting the shortfall and we're at a cyclical peak. Our unemployment rate's been the lowest it's been in 40 years. So, you know, we're not in a recession, and then revenue's going to come back when the economy improves. So that suggests that it's a structural shortfall. And of course, that means, you know, you can deal with that from either end of the budget, either through the expenditure side or the revenue side or both. But in terms of the longer term, you look out and you know, I think there should be two things to be thought about. One is how do you close that structural deficit over time so that you're going to have periods where in a recession your revenues may drop below your expenditure needs. That's where you need reserve funds. But that you match your budget commitments, that if you're growing a trend in terms of your revenue stream, you should be able to match your budget commitments. Otherwise, it's not sustainable. So that would be obvious one goal. The other goal is to try to have a system that is less responsive to the business cycle so that those periods of recession are less painful. You're never going to make them not painful, but make them less painful. So those, I think, are the two fiscal goals to think about longer term. And so by looking at the structural revenue issues, you're looking at a broader base of taxation and ways to generate revenue at trend growth. In terms of the cyclical, you're looking at a more stable stream.
I do want to try and get us out of here by 10 o'clock. All of the documents that Paul's presented are in OLIS, including one that shows the differences from what the work group came up with in its recommendations from Measure 97. And I really thank you for these questions. I think most of us in the work group would agree these are pretty good questions. Mm-hmm. And it came up today. Yeah. And Paul, how you doing?
Well, I'm doing fine, Mr. Chair. I may have to go for a walk, but
yeah.
I thought one thing I do want to tell the members is that, you know, as we work through this, encourage you, if you've got questions or materials you would like us to bring, just let us know. And as we work through this, because there's a lot to it, obviously.
We have we will go out then with a video.
Okay. Okay.
That some of you have seen already, and it's done by the Oregonian. And 20 years ago when I was in the news business, if I would have ever dreamed that I'd be introducing a video done by the Oregonian in the legislature, it seems like a strange dream. But they did a great job in explanatory journalism, and I think it's a good way to end this hearing.
And if I could, just to give a quick announcement, the fact that House members that you've attended this meeting this morning does not excuse you from the 1 o'clock meeting this afternoon. We will be meeting at 1 o'clock.
Last year, Oregon voters rejected Measure 97. Now, without that added tax revenue, the state faces a $1.6 billion budget gap. And Oregon's current system, the state's corporate income tax, isn't sustainable because more companies are finding ways to avoid it. Now, lawmakers are looking at other corporate tax systems, like the ones in Ohio, Washington, and Texas. Here's how they work. Ohio's commercial activity tax is a 0.26% tax on sales over $1 million. Most companies, big and small, pay it, and it brings in $145 per resident per year. The pros? It's simple. There's one rate for just about everyone, and it's easy for companies to pay and for the state to administer. It's also hard to avoid. Like Measure 97, this tax doesn't offer many loopholes. Finally, it has what's called a broad base and low rate, meaning with more businesses paying, the burden is spread out. The cons? Like Measure 97, this tax can be unfair to low-margin businesses like grocers. It's also subject to what's called a pyramid effect, where items are taxed several times during the production process. For example, a t-shirt would be taxed once when the raw material is sold to a manufacturer, and again when the t-shirt is sold to a retailer. Finally, if costs are passed down to consumers, it acts like a sales tax, which is harder on people with low incomes. Up next is Texas's franchise tax. It's a hybrid between a corporate income tax, like Oregon's current system, and a gross receipts tax, like Measure 97. Most companies are taxed between 1/3% and 0.75% on their total sales, minus one of four possible deductions. Most companies pay it, and it brings in $139 per resident per year. Pros? Again, the broad-based, somewhat low-rate thing, where the burden is spread out because more businesses are paying. It's also a little more fair because the deductions give discounts to small businesses and retailers with slim profit margins. Finally, it's easy for the state. There are only a few different rates, so it's easy to administer. Cons? Each year, companies must make four separate calculations to figure out which deduction they should take. It's also subject to the pyramid effect, where items are taxed several times during the production process. Finally, it too acts like a sales tax, which is harder on people with low incomes. Finally, lawmakers are looking at Washington's business and occupation tax. It's a gross receipts tax like Measure 97. Most businesses are taxed at a range of rates under 0.5%, except for professional services like law or dental offices, which are taxed at 1.5%. Most businesses pay it, and it brings in $498 per resident per year. Pros, again with the broad-based low rate, the burden is spread out, and it's a little more fair. The state offers dozens of different rates for different types of companies, so low-margin businesses generally pay less. Cons? It's hard to administer. The dozens of categories mean the state has to make sure the companies are filing under the right category and they're getting the proper rate. It's also subject to the pyramid effect, where items are taxed several times during production. And again, it acts like a sales tax, which, if passed on to consumers, can be harder on people with low incomes. Oregon lawmakers haven't decided yet which route to take, but leaders are hoping to reform corporate taxation by the end of the legislative session.
Thank you all, committee.
We are adjourned.
Okay, so we learn more from her. And